radiated power. You can communicate 600 to 800 miles fairly reliably with what's called forward propagated tropospheric scatter. What is that? The majority of that is atmospheric inhomogeneity. In other words, because you've got little portions of the atmosphere that have pockets of air that are hot, cold, clouds, non-clouds, and whatever, all of those slight differences in dielectric constant of those local chunks of atmosphere are creating scattering. It's like having the much larger equivalent of a bunch of dust clouds, dust particles in the atmosphere of your living room. Let me drop them. When the sun shines through a slit in the curtain of your living room, through the window, and you see all of those dust particles flowing through the air in your living room, and you see the reflection off of them in that environment, that's sort of what's propagating through forward propagated RF tropospheric scatter. When I talk to somebody 480 miles away, K4CAW, on 432 megacycles, as I did for four solid years every Tuesday night for half an hour, the atmosphere was doing that. That's how we were getting 90% of reliability, summer, winter, spring, and fall. My radio horizon from my 100-foot high tower, my 300-foot land, my radio horizon is 40 miles out. It was 480 miles away. As long as I used 1,000 watts of power into a 30 dB gain antenna, and he used something similar on that end, we talked 480 miles, day in and day out. But the atmosphere was doing it. Mars has so little atmosphere, you ain't going to get that effect. So you better stake out the high ground, and you better put out the put the repeaters on those mountains on Mars, is my first guess, to get reliable communication. Or set up systems that talk from ground to satellite and satellite back to ground. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, great answers. So I'm sure these guys are going to be very happy tonight. Dick put me down for a question after Paul because what you spoke about before brought a question to mind. So just mark me up for a question. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And I have a comment on Mojave Desert.
Let's see if Paul's available, and then we'll go to the Mojave Desert. WS2N, are you on deck tonight, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW.
S2N and listening to the Mars radio propagation theory. Very good.
Okay. Tell us what Curiosity's been doing. By the way, with all of the material that you've collected on keeping track of what NASA is doing, do you remember seeing articles about any of the Mars spacecraft seeing an aurora on Mars? That was one of the earlier questions of all. WS2N, K2RAW.
I think Wesley said it was on Mars Global Surveyor. That's now a defunct satellite going around Mars, but I'll have to check to see what instruments they had on that. Most of them have about six to ten instruments on board. I think that one had six. And whether or not that has the capability of detecting any kind of an aurora, like John said, if there's anything hidden there, it would be diffused. If we did away with our magnetic field, the same amount of particles would be hitting the Earth, but you know it would be all over everywhere. Because of our denser atmosphere, though, we would probably see an aurora, you know, at the equator. Chances of seeing that on Mars would be zero. But I guess some instruments might be able to pick it up on MGS, you know, Mars Global Surveyor, but. Don't know, Dick. I have a comment about Voyager, though. I mean, we're up to 35 years. We want to talk about Voyager. I know we've talked about Voyager quite a bit, but Voyager 1, 35 years later.
And aren't we happy that that nuclear radioactive thermal electric generator on that Voyager is still cranking out some number of watts of power 35 years later? That is a power supply. Back to you, Paul.
I saw another interview with Ed Stone. He repeated what I said a couple of months ago. 20 watts is still coming out. I don't know about that, but he says there's 20 watts coming out of that radio. and now transmitting 17 hours in one direction. Voyager 1. Voyager 2 is a little closer. Voyager 1 at around 11 billion, and Voyager 2 is around 9 billion miles out. Every year it goes 3 billion, 1 billion miles every year, 1 billion. I think I got it backwards. Every three years, it's 1 billion miles that thing travels, both of them. So, they're doing the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, which they have on Curiosity. They've had it on Ulysses spacecraft going around the sun. They have it on Cassini presently going around Saturn. They're all very reliable instruments, including New Horizon going out to Pluto. Let me drop it. The idea was many, many years ago that they came up with that, and they've improved on the systems, and they can make them last a very long time. Voyager, they expect to go to at least 2020, and the reason they fail is because the thermoelectric contact tends to degrade after a while with the heat. Not so much the plutonium, the half-life of plutonium 239, I think is, I don't know, tremendous, you know, 50, 100 years or something, whatever it is. But they'll keep going. Right now their goal is to get this thing into interstellar space. They expect it to happen within either days or a couple of years. But they do expect it to happen where the intergalactic rays will be picked up, the cosmic rays, by Voyager, and they'll send that information back. And right now, again, 17 light hours to make it to Earth. And they're heading, one's going north of the ecliptic of the solar system, and the other one is going south. And they're active. Both of them are active. The Pioneer spacecraft, they're also going out of the stellar space. Let me drop it. Those things are not functioning. They're not sending information back. Well, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 still are. And, 35 years, still active, the longest operating interplanetary spacecraft ever. Originally, they started out, they were going to have four different spacecraft. You know, one was going to go to Pluto, the other one was going to go to Uranus, Neptune, and they're going to split it up, you know, and they decided, hey, let's just use these two, and the way the planets were aligned at that time, they figured, okay, we'll just send it out to Jupiter, Saturn, and when they got to Saturn, that was their main goal, going to Jupiter and Saturn, and then they said, why not send one of them, in this case Voyager 2, to Uranus and Neptune, and they did that, and they wanted to get a close look at Titan, the moon Titan around Saturn, so they diverted Voyager 1 a little bit, and that's why that went. It didn't go out to the other two planets, but it did go, on an angle like 45 degrees out of the ecliptic. And, the cameras have been shut down for a long time. Let me drop it. This WS2N. Back a little over 20 years ago, I think it was 1990, they had Voyager turn around and take a picture of the planets. They made a mosaic, and that was the final use of the cameras. They decided they didn't need them anymore. They just needed the equipment on board to just operate the magnetometers and cosmic detectors and all of that, and of course the radio. So if you want to hear where these things are going, I'll let you know, Dick. We got a long wait before they get to the nearest star. WS2N.
Yeah, at the speed of light, current 86,000 miles per second, 300 million meters per second, Each hour is 680 million miles, so 17 hours one way is 11 billion miles. So that voyage is approximately 11 billion miles away. And Pluto is something like 3 and a fraction billion miles away, so it's 3.5 times the distance of Pluto. Now it's really down the road a piece. That is by far the furthest reaching piece of hardware ever issued by mankind that we know about. I can't think of the guy's name now. John, let's see now, billions and billions. You know who I'm trying to think of? Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan's favorite illustrator made sure that each one of these spacecraft had on board some form of communication describing to whatever society that picks it up where it came from and why we want to talk to them. So I think the Voyager has a record on board, if I remember, which has hello in many languages in the United States and many of the sounds of Earth. And I think it's also got a map. It's got a brief diagram of what a man and a woman look like, and I think it's got a map that shows where the sun is with reference to other known pulsars, which we think are major markers in space. Am I correct? Is it Voyager that's got this fancy plaque on board, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW?
The Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft. But Voyager, you know, they've got the gold record on board, the gold-plated record. And they got the, you know, sounds of the whales and hello in all the different languages and where we're located and all of this. And, some people didn't like the idea, you know, some alien's going to find this and going to come back and vaporize Earth, you know. So that was some of the controversy that they had back then. But he had his way, and it's going to be a long time. Pioneer has the symbols of the man, woman, and the pulsars, and nearest pulsars, and where we're located to those pulsars. Some kind of triangulation type of setup. This way they can find us. The problem is with Pioneer 10 and 11, they're going like along the ecliptic, one in one direction and 180 degrees the other direction. When they get to their nearest stars, one of them is going to be about 2 million years from now. So we've got a long way to that. And the other one is about 4 million years before it gets to its nearest star. So I don't think we have to worry about that too much. Voyager 1 and 2, they're going to get to their nearest stars around 40,000 years from now. Nah, that's not too bad. One of them, I think it's Voyager 2, will be coming to very close to a star called Ross 248. And if you remember the early stars that are closest to us, the Barnard star, and then the next one is Wolf 359. There's three or four more stars. I think Ross 248 is around the sixth or seventh star out away from Earth. We drop it. You think about radio transmission. Now, this thing gets to Ross 248 40,000 years from now. And for some reason, the plutonium on board kept working. We still have a transmitter. But it'll probably be dead within about 8, 9, 10 years. But say it kept working, and it made it around this star. And by the way, it'll only get within 1.7 light years of that star. So, that would be the equivalent of being in between, halfway between us and the nearest star, Alpha Centauri. Alpha Centauri is about 4 light years out. This thing would be about, the equivalent of half that distance. So, now it finally gets to Ross 248 and starts transmitting. We would only have to wait 10 light years to hear from this thing. That's not too bad. Problem is, it's going to take 40,000 years to get there at that speed. WS2N.
We've got to find a way of communicating with something that moves faster than 186,000 miles per second, 680 million miles an hour. Light is too slow when it comes to these huge differences. That's a toughie. 17 hours one way. And because it is a transponder, in other words, you send it a signal in order for it to send the signal back to you, the Voyager spacecraft, round-trip communication is 34 hours.
Wow.
That's a delay line. 34-hour delay line. All it requires is 11 billion miles of space and a repeater out there. It tells you that electronic repeating is a lot more efficient than passive reflection. The Echo satellites that were put up around the Earth, the 1960 or so time frame, were nowhere near as effective as Telstar. Telstar had real active gain on board. Just putting up a great big balloon and think you're going to get reliable communication, just like trying to use the moon as a passive reflector. You can do it, but it's not high-speed, high-quality data. It's not a nice, clean reflector. It's got a whole lot of depth to it. It's got a whole lot of pockmarks in it. So radar-like echoes off of a target that's nearby, a small number of miles away, pretty easy. But to get a radar echo off of something that's millions of miles away, nowhere near as easy, nowhere near as effective. It's a tough way to go. What's the next thing that... by the way, I know that now that it is three times the distance of Pluto, Voyager is, I believe it's right at the threshold where the solar wind is stopping and now the galactic wind is starting to take over. I think we're essentially at that threshold where we're, by all measurements, about to leave this solar system.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I think that spacecraft is about to leave this solar system, and you could say it's about to enter the galactic system. And you can tell that by measuring the number of impacts they're getting from the solar wind particles. I think those solar wind particle impacts and the direction that they come from our sun is starting to decrease, and the particles coming from some other direction is starting to increase. I believe I've read something along those lines. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, oh yeah. A few years back, they noticed the change of direction of the solar wind. You know, it was always coming from one direction, and then it's bouncing off the heliopause. It's starting to come in from another direction, and they knew then that they were getting close. So a few more years, it'll come down to essentially zero. They relocated, you know, they changed the space, the spacecraft in space. This way it picks the signals up, the cosmic rays from different angles. They could tell when it's going to come to a virtual stop, and then once they get beyond that, it'll be a much calmer, in more in one direction, but not from the sun, but you know, from the other direction, from the galactic cloud. I guess all your other stars that collectively are sending cosmic rays out to space. It'll start picking up that, and then they'll know that they'll be on that point, but. You know, is it truly beyond the solar system, you know, the sun's influence? I don't think so. Let me drop it. Because the physical, separation between our solar system and anything else as far as the influence of the sun, physically, I would say yes. But gravitationally, no. Because you still have you're actually out into and almost really past the Kuiper belt, or the trillions of probably in the middle of it, but trillions of comets, possible comets, could come back into Earth. But you're nowhere near the Oort cloud. The Kuiper belt is like trillions of rocks that follow the same orbital plane as all the planets, you know, like a photograph, phonograph disc. But the Oort cloud is like a big sphere around the whole everything, the whole sun and all the planets are dropping. I'm estimating that the Oort cloud goes out to roughly one-third the distance between us and the nearest star, Alpha Centauri. So to get out that far, you know, that's you're still looking at, you know, thousands of years maybe before you get to that point. So, you know, gravitationally, I don't think you're well, actually, in reality, you're never going to be away from the influence of the sun. I mean, theoretically, the gravity goes on forever, but in order to influence of all planets pull on, I mean, stars and everything pull on one another. But, you know, to get past that Oort cloud, I mean, the reason that's there is because of our sun. And then the Oort cloud is responsible for these million period comets that come in. You know, a comet will come in and they'll say, where'd this thing come from? It's not one of these that are going to come back every couple of hundred years like Halley's Comet, but, you know, maybe once every million years. And those things come in from the Oort cloud, and they could come in from north of, you know, the north pole of the sun, you know, come in that angle. They don't necessarily have to come in from the same plane as the Kuiper Belt. Back to the WS cloud.
Is there anything that we should look forward to as to what's going to happen in the next week with Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory? Back to you, Paul.
No, but they got the three-dimensional pictures up. I've got to come up with my colored glasses. Don't know where they went. But we got the different colored glasses. It was blue and red glasses. Scion and whatever the colors they use, but anything blue and red, you can see these nice three-dimensional pictures of Mount Sharp. But presently, you know, they're on their way to Glenel, the three areas come together, and they're going to investigate that probably within a month, and then after investigating that, then they'll start heading toward the, I guess what you would call the foothills of Mount Sharp, which might take another couple of months. So it's slow, but, you know, they'll be doing experiments along the way, using their laser, using the arm to do tests here and there. And, of course, all that will be sent back, and scientists will get a hold of it. They'll be dicing through this thing for the next probably 10, 20 years. Back to you, Dick.
Roughly how far has it traveled so far? It sounds like it's really rolling now. Is it true, Paul? They've done most of the preliminary testing, confirmed that everything's working, and now it's time to start rolling toward a target?
Everything's working. Well, except for part of the one of the, you know, I have a weather station on board, and I think some of the rocks from the landing damaged. Well, they have two setups, you know, two types of weather detecting equipment on board, and one of them was damaged, and they think they can get around it using the other one from what I read to still get the same measurements. I'm not sure of the capabilities that they lost, but yeah, 99.9, everything is working, and as far as I know, I mean, the last time I looked was about a week ago, and they rolled that up around 100 feet, and they were taking a day off to do some tests, sitting in one place, including a panoramic view. I assume they started moving on, although I don't know that. But they got a long way to go to get to their first main location. Back to you.
So I think you're saying they've rolled around 100 feet so far, Paul?
Well, it would be further than that. I mean, that was the long one day they did 100 feet. So that's pretty good. And it has the capability of going, I think, 1.7 inches per second. I think that's this speed. So you can figure that out. But, you know, they could probably go, I think, a couple of hundred feet a day. So that means that they probably, collectively, they probably gone, I guess they've gone probably 300 feet. Because I remember one picture looking back, and I think that was a couple of days after they first started going, and I was like 75 feet away from where they started. They're probably, I'll have to check. I don't know how far they've gone. I don't know what the odometer reads yet.
WJTB with a question. Yeah, that's a very small fraction of a mile per hour. Go ahead, Joe.
Thanks, Dick. WJTB. I got one question, one serious question, and one not so serious question. The serious question is, I was just wondering if they brought any type of reflective apparatus that they could shine a laser towards Mars and get a reflection back. Because I know I heard they did something like that on the moon. They were able to make very accurate measurements as to the movement between the two planets using a laser reflectivity device that they had planted on the moon. I'm just curious if there's anything like that that came with the Mars rover. And my not-so-serious question is if the Mars rover gets some pictures of some Martians running around, are they actually going to publish those pictures? What do you think, WJTB?
I'm not sure if Apollo 11 did it or Apollo 12 or 14, but one of those Apollos did put on the moon a corner reflector, an array of corner reflectors, and when you aim a laser beam at that, you get a much stronger reflection from that than you do from the lunar soil. So you can now make some very accurate ranging measurements on the moon with a corner reflector array. I don't think anyone has planned to do that on Mars for about five reasons. Number one, Moon is a quarter of a million miles away. Mars is right now in the vicinity of 300 million miles. By inverse square law, the size of a laser beam required to aim at Mars, if you had a real good-sized corner reflector and get an echo back from it, I doubt it. I think you're way ahead of the game to do radio ranging, and I think we have radio ranged Mars, Venus, I believe Mercury, and I think Sun at a very low HF frequency. So radio ranging, radar reflecting like things have been done. But laser on Mars, I doubt it highly. But Paul, more familiar with all the instruments that are on the Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity, I doubt there's a retro reflector on there. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Reflector. They got a laser beam, but I mean, it puts out what the equivalent of a million watts, something like that. Million degrees on a 40 watt system to blast a rock, but no reflectors. And if they did, it wouldn't be on Curiosity. It would leave it stable. It would have been better like on Phoenix, the one that landed in the northern hemisphere. But there's no way you're gonna reflect a signal back. I guess it would be so wide by the time it got, so diffused by the time it got to Mars, you know. It just wouldn't work. But yeah, I believe it was Apollo 12 that they did that. They left those reflecting devices up, and they still work, you know. I think some app in Texas still does it. You could do it if you had enough money. You could set up a laser and shoot it to the Apollo 12 site. I mean, you don't need to plug batteries into this thing. It looks like if you looked at it close, it looks like a bunch of pyramids. Like about 40 different little pyramids, you know, all ganged together. I guess when you hit it with the laser, it's going to go in all different directions or something. This way you're sure to see it. I don't get that whole setup, but you've ever seen it. It looks like a bunch of little pyramids. It's not like a flat glass.
Paul, each one of those pyramid-shaped devices, depending on how you take the photograph, really is a corner reflector. If you take three orthogonal flat sheets of metal and bring them together in an X, Y, and Z axis, you get a corner reflector. The good news about a corner reflector is no matter what angle the signal comes in to that corner at, it'll reflect off those three surfaces and come right back at the exact same angle. So it gives you the maximum reflection in that angle. Angle of incident equals angle of reflection. Well, angle of input equals the exact same angle of output, is what I'm trying to say. It really is a retroreflector. Each one of those corner cubes runs at near 100% efficiency, and there's something like 40 of them. So you get a nice strong echo from that. The only reason for putting a corner reflector on Mars or Moon is to get exact timing of the distance. We've already got that. The electronics on board, the so-called deep space network, does that for you, Joe. The way the deep space network works, you would think an ordinary radio has a local oscillator. You send up a radio signal, the local oscillator beats it down to an IF, demodulates the signal, generates the information you want, and then remodulates it back up and sends it back to you. And therefore, the accuracy of the signal you get back down on the ground is partially a function of the accuracy of the oscillators on board. That would be conventional radio. That's not the way the deep space network works. The deep space network has a ratio of 240 over 221. In other words, it literally counts every single cycle of the uplink signal, divides it by 240 over 221, and then sends back down that signal on that frequency. The signal it sends back down to you is exactly related to the signal you sent up. You can literally count every cycle that you sent up, count every cycle it came back down, and even though you're 300 million miles...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Even though you're 300 million miles away, you're getting range resolution, and in theory accuracy, of centimeters. You're measuring centimeters of difference. So as a satellite goes around Mars and experiences a mass concentration and dips down a little bit, its velocity goes up or down, and by way of the deep space network, you can see that. So you've got a much better system in that deep space network than you would have with a laser ranging system, as I see it, Joe. So what you're looking for is already there. And if somebody goes walking around on Mars, are they going to publish that picture? Well, I don't think you're going to find anybody walking around on Mars. You may believe so, and there's been a lot of science fiction about that. We used to think that Mars had a lot of life on it. We used to think those canals were changing between summer, winter, spring, and fall, and we now are a lot smarter. It turns out the canals that Mr. Schiaparelli was seeing, he thought he was seeing intelligence on Mars. There was intelligence there, but it was on the wrong side of the telescope, if you know what I mean. So I wonder if you've heard that about the very accurate ranging system that the deep space network has. Almost all of our spacecraft communicate with the deep space network in that manner. WJ2B, K2RIW.
Very good day. I've heard stuff about it, like bits and pieces. I never really put it all together until you so nicely explained it. It's very interesting, and I haven't read much about it on the internet. Maybe that gives me some reason to go research a little bit. But I never knew that they had that accurate of a ranging on radio waves out that far. I thought that was why they, I guess back in the day of the Apollo, the technology wasn't there that they decided to use a laser, and now with the radio technology that exists, they can use radio waves to do the ranging. But yes, it's a very interesting subject. It's so many facets and so many different aspects of the space program that people have absolutely no idea. That's why these space reports are so interesting, and the questions that get asked are very interesting, and everybody here explains it very well and enlightens everybody. So much to be learned about it that people have absolutely no idea. Thanks for the input, Dick. WJ2B.
Question about that, Dick. Same topic.
Very fine, Joe. And as you can tell with Joe's enthusiasm, and he's not alone, of all the email that I get because of the TechNet, a significant percentage of it is people appreciating the space report that we give. So as I see it, Paul, WS2N, you have job security. You've got a position with this organization for a long time to come. We're going to renew your contract. WS2N, KQRIW. Go ahead, Paul.
WGB with a question, Dick.
Right after Paul. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I was wondering what you think the accuracy of compared to the laser is. The laser, they did a measurement within 6 inches. They could tell exactly within 6 inches. And of course, then, but with that, they could tell that the moon is also drifting away. They know where, I think it's one or two centimeters every year. But compare the accuracy. Can you get that 6 inches with radio?
I think they're doing better than that, Paul. The way the Deep Space Network works, and when I had my visit down at Houston, 1971, I think that was, right after Apollo 15, I got flown down to Houston, got a chance to talk to some of the engineers involved, got a chance to meet some astronauts and whatever, sat on the lunar rover car. This is after I was publishing that article in QST called Houston, This is Apollo, where we described the Apollo 15 and 16 reception that we did. And they handed me the green book, as I call it. There's a book that's about an inch and a half thick, 8.5 by 11, in which the Deep Space Network is described. Very well-designed system. By literally counting every cycle of the radio signal you send up and counting every cycle that came back down, you've got range resolution of inches, maybe it's centimeters. It's a very fine resolution. That's resolution. Now, the word accuracy has a different meaning. If you ran the radio system continuously and never interrupted it, and they don't have that much time on the 250-foot dish at Goldstone and all the other three dishes, they don't have that much time to run it continuously. If you ran it continuously, you'd never, in theory, lose a cycle. You'd know exact accuracy to inches out of millions of miles, out of hundreds of millions of miles. However, you make a measurement today, you turn off the radio, you come back a couple days later and you turn the radio back on. They send up a pseudo-random code and you get back the pseudo-random code and that gives you coarse lockup. Then the individual cycle counting gives you fine lockup. And now, are there cycles that can be slipped in between? I'm not sure. So the exact accuracy, they got great range resolution during a period of measurement. But from day to day of turning the radio off and turning it back on and reestablishing lock, are they getting the exact same range accuracy? There, I'm not sure. When I get a chance, I'm going to go take a look at my green book.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When I get a chance, I'm going to take a look at my green book and see if I can figure that one out. And there's another thing worried about here. Whether I'm using a laser, radio beam, or whatever, in order to do exact ranging to centimeters, you have to make an assumption about the speed of light. Well, when the speed of light is being measured in a vacuum, in theory we know that to 10 decimal places of accuracy. But when that radio beam goes through the Mars atmosphere and the Earth atmosphere, and because the air mass expands and contracts depending on the state of the ionosphere of the sunspot sun, and so on. So the number of nanoseconds and microseconds it takes for a radio beam to penetrate the atmosphere that's above the Goldstone station today is a variable you've got to worry about. And that variable might be greater than the inaccuracy of the radio system itself. But still, the smart of the system is that it doesn't depend on the frequency accuracy of a local oscillator on board the spacecraft. So as long as you've got an active spacecraft that can do the transponding for you in the Deep Space Network, you've got extremely high range resolution, and probably with the right use of enough of the pseudo-random codes, you probably can get enough absolute accuracy out of it. But there's a catch. Let me drop. In order for that to work, you have to have an active piece of radio equipment at that location. To my knowledge, the only thing that's active on the moon at this time for a while was the ALSA packages, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages. And I'm not sure whether or not they turned that on or off. I think that's also running on a nuclear power supply, radioactive thermal electric generator.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so the ALSA packages on each one of the astronauts dropping, are you saying every one of those, to your knowledge, is active at this time, Paul?
They're active now, but they did have them. They also had solar panels up there. But they had the, I think Apollo 12 was the first one. Yeah, they were the first ones to bring the radioisotopes, thermoelectric generator, for whatever.
Okay. So as long as you've got an active piece of network of radio electronics on that planet that you care about, then the Deep Space Network is going to give you about the best accuracy you're going to get of ranging. And I think it's going to challenge the ranging accuracy you get out of a laser. And going to the moon, laser is practical. Using a laser to Mars, I don't think it's practical. The radio system will do it for you. The laser system with a corner reflector is a passive reflector. And passive reflector has to experience the inverse square law, free space loss on the way up, and inverse path loss, free space loss on the way down. The signal you're going to get that right back down is going to be tremendously weaker. But if the circuit on board is a chunk of active electronics that's got 150 decibels of gain, then the uplink versus downlink signal becomes 150 decibels easier. And as long as you're smart enough to design the circuits like that Deep Space Network, then you've got an awful lot of what you're looking for. I think you're saying, see where we're going here. Let me pass it back to Joe for a quick one on that, and then I'm going to go over to John. WJ2B, K2LIW.
That's a very good explanation. It's very interesting. I'm surprised that none of the ham radio community has tried to do an Earth-Mars-Earth communication yet. I know the Earth-Moon-Earth contest is coming up in a couple of weeks, so I guess Earth-Mars-Earth is going to be pretty difficult without a, like you said, an active reflector there or something that will amplify the signal and send it back like a repeater. So thanks to me if I think I appreciate it, WJ2B.
One of the popular frequency regions that's used for moon bounce is the 432 megacycle band. On 432 megacycle, when you and I transmit a signal from Long Island up to the moon and reflect back, and you calculate what would the real path loss be, it's in the vicinity of 263 decibels. You add up all of the gain of the transmitting antenna, the receiving antenna, the amount of echo you get off the moon, which is a 7% echo, the amount of power you transmitted, and the sensitivity receiver. You add up all of those numbers, Joe, and you can come out positive versus negative on 263 decibels of free space path loss. Earth up to moon, reflect, and back to Earth. You've got to come out ahead or behind 263 dB, and you either do or don't communicate under normal circumstances before you start using the Joe Taylor digital computer techniques. And so that's what happens at 432 at 10 gigahertz. I think the number, instead of being 263, is something like 293 dB. The numbers add up real fast. So when you compare 250,000 miles, that's where those numbers I just gave you came from, versus 300 million miles to Mars. Unless you and I are using a 50-kilowatt transmitter into a 250-foot dish at Goldstone, California, on both transmit and receive, and then use a very fancy phase-lock loop system with a 1 hertz noise-equivalent bandwidth for receiving, until you start using that kind of hardware, we're not going to get an echo off of Mars, Joe. You and I can dream about it. And by the way, there are amateurs that have listened to the beacon signals on various spacecraft on the way to Mars and Venus. So amateurs have listened to the active signal coming out of a satellite. But when it comes to an echo off of a planet, I think it's a lot of dBs beyond your and my backyard capability, Joe. We can dream about it, but it's going to be a while before we can do that one. It's going to take some other fancy techniques. Not even the Joe Taylor computer technique can handle that one yet. But Joe is no slouch. If there's a way, he'll find it. Give him some time. Go ahead with your set of questions, John. KC2WGD, K2LAW.
1 second, John. WS2N. The government, our government did that. They bounced a signal off of Venus and got a signal back. Quite a few years, many decades ago, they did do that.
You're absolutely right, Paul. So far, our government, so to speak, which in one case was really Stanford University. Stanford University is setting up that phased array at something like 27 megacycles, close to a square mile antenna, bounce the 27 megacycle signal off of the sun. So we've reflected signals, radio signals, off of sun, Venus, Mars, and I think that's the limit so far. Whether or not they bounced off of Jupiter, I'm not sure. So our government has done planet bounce on Venus and Mars, and I'm not sure about Mercury, but I know they've done it with the sun. So if you use a big enough chunk of hardware and enough transmitting power and enough computer processing on the received signal, you can do it. But is it practical? Can you transmit a signal at a fast enough data rate that it represents a useful signal? I mean, if you get a confirmation that you've got an echo and it takes you an hour of integrating to get it, that's not a very fast data rate. You're not going to really say, hello, send me a QSL card. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, yeah, that's for sure. I'm always taxing Paul's brain, but I have a question. I believe he stated it was $2.5 billion to put Curiosity on Mars. Okay, do we have any idea what it's costing us percentage-wise of the NASA budget, or a yearly figure between the assets and the population of engineers that are doing the work and all the other people? What portion of the budget, or do you have a dollar figure per year on that, Paul, possibly? Back to you, Dave, KC2WGB.
By the way, $2.5 billion, I think, is the price of producing the hardware, launching it, getting it there, and I believe it's some amount of time of running it. And by the way, when you divide the 330 million people in the United States versus the 2.5 billion, and by the way, the 2.5 billion isn't only United States money. An awful lot of other countries are contributing to that. But if the United States was paying the complete bill, and we produced all of the hardware, nobody else did, that turns out to be $7.57 per man, woman, and child. I know I've gotten my money's worth out of that one. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I concur. Yeah, well, yeah, Russia has got the detector that's looking under the ground for water, signs of water. Spain is the one that put up the weather detecting units. And, of course, you've got to divide this. This started 10 years ago. Take that $2.5 billion and divide that above, you know, you got to separate that 10 years. I mean, development, launch on the Atlas V, sent to a rocket up at stage, and that are now to for a 2-year mission, 2-year Earth mission, 1-year Mars mission, and then you know what's going to happen after that. Many, many extended missions, but then that'll come out of a new budget, but very small budget because it's only an operating budget with the Deep Space Network and people on the ground. I mean, look at Voyager. Right now, they don't even have full time. People once in a while, part-time scientists or an engineer go in there and communicate with Voyager, and they'll come back, you know, a day and a half later and find out what the response was. The cost is very cheap after you landed there. That's why to cancel, let's say, Opportunity now would be a disaster. It's been there for since 2004, and you know, it might be there for another 10 years, and you don't have to pay to get it there. Overall cost for NASA, I think about, what, 6 or 8 years ago, I mean, they're cutting the budget left and right. I think it was around $18 billion per year, John, to give you an idea.
Well, I'll tell you, Paul, if they would take a donation from the people and say, I'd send $100, we could do it 3 more times. But only if the money went directly to NASA, not through the government's fingertips. I think they could get a lot more done. Bigger bang for the buck. Dick, back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, there are high school students and grade school students who found out that we're canceling the space shuttle. I may have the mission wrong, but I know that a number of those students collected money, mailed it to NASA, saying that if you're not gonna, if the government's not going to fund it, we will. Of course, it was a gesture that represents a certain attitude. And by the way, since Curiosity was built over a 10-year period, instead of a $7.57 per man, woman, and child, it's 75 cents per year. But even if I pay it all for it in 1 year, I can't go to a cheap movie these days for $7. And the movie lasts for 2.5 hours. I'm going to get years of pleasure out of that Curiosity. I know I'm getting my money's worth. 75 cents per year, I'll go for that. Let's launch 10 more of them. So it's hard to judge. I mean, yes, you're going to get people who say, gee, $2.5 billion for a science experiment on Mars to look for the presence of water and the possibility of past life. And I could be using that to feed the poor people in the United States, the people who are not being fed. And it sounds nice on paper. You go through the specifics of actually doing that. It doesn't solve the problem. There's a big difference between teaching a person how to go fishing and to give a person a fish, to give them a meal, versus an occupation. I hope we start doing more renewable energy resource production or infrastructure repair. What they did during the Works Projects Administration, what they did after the big crash of 1929 to restore the economy and fix the roads and bridges and establish new roads and so on, that worked rather well from what little I know in that time frame. And
repeater, timeout, cancel.
It worked rather well then. I think we got to do it again. To some degree we are, but maybe we're not doing it fast enough. And there's something else that's bothering me, and that is somebody could make an estimation that the Hewlett Packard Company is going to have, when they pick a number out of the air, a $1.5 per profit per stock, per piece of stock in the next year. Somebody could make an estimate that they're going to profit $1.50. And pretty soon they find out the year has gone by. Instead of $1.50, they only profit $1.40. And somebody said they didn't make their schedule, they didn't meet their planned amount, and therefore the stock's going to go down. Hey, fella, they did make $1.40. The estimate was wrong. By the same token, somebody estimated that the unemployment rate is going to be going down to some number. And our unemployment definitely went down, but didn't quite meet that number. We're moving in the right direction. Things are getting better. But it didn't quite move fast enough to make everybody happy. It isn't necessarily that the process is wrong. The estimation was wrong. There are times when that is confused, and I think it creates a negative attitude. We are moving in the right direction. More jobs are being formed. Yes, we wish they were being formed faster. Where's the funding and the intelligence going to come from to do that? And would the discrepancies, the disagreements between Republicans and Democrats allow those effects to take place? Let me drop. There is some evidence that the Republicans decided that they want to make sure the economy doesn't look good so that they stand a chance of establishing more people on the next election. In other words, getting more of their people in power seemed to be more important than correcting the problem of unemployment. There is some evidence that that could have been taking place. At least Mr. Clinton, with his arithmetic, seemed to say that rather strongly. So, are we really not moving ahead? Yes, we're not moving ahead at the rate that everybody would like to be moving ahead. And if anybody's got a glamour fix, it's time they should come forward and really say what it should be. Bunch of attitudes. Bunch of opinions. I think you had a real question you wanted to ask, John, so go right ahead. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yes, I do, Dick. It's off the space topic. But first of all, let me tell you, working for many of the publishers throughout the country, exactly what you said, it's how you look at something. The bottom line guys, and these are multi-million dollar corporations, they made $4 million this year, and the new year, they made $3 million. To them, they lost $1 million. So, you know, who's right. But just like you said, hey, wait a minute, but you made $3 million. They don't look at it that way. They lost $1 million. Very confusing. Let me let it drop and I'll go to my question. KC2WGB. Dick, before you were talking about the ferry rod antenna, and it brought to mind a question. I haven't run this experiment yet, but before I try it, I'd like to get your input. If you have a regular little transistor radio with a ferro antenna, now, that rod, which is usually around maybe 6 inches long and maybe 3/8 in diameter, if I were to put a neodymium magnet on each end and saturate that ferrite rod, what effect would that have on the reception, if any? Thank you, Dick. KC2WGB.
It's my guess it would move you up in frequency. When you tune that ferrite rod, it really is a coil of wire around a magnetic material that's got a certain mu, certain permeability. The effective permeability of material that is being saturated definitely goes down. That's how a magnetic amplifier works. You've got an extra set of windings on that magnetic core of a magnetic amplifier. You start saturating it, and the amount of inductive reactance decreases. Therefore, the current flow through that circuit increases because it's in series with the motor, we'll say. So you can definitely decrease the inductance of any coil on a magnetic material by saturating the magnetic material. So you will tune it to a higher frequency when you do that. On top of that, I think the saturation is going to make the Q go down a little bit. So as you move it up in frequency by using that technique, I think the insertion loss of that network as an antenna will increase. So I think you're going to get a higher frequency, weaker signal when you do that. That's my guess, Paul. John, as I see it, if your antenna in its H field dimensions and E field dimensions is, let me drop, if it's a small fraction of a wavelength in those dimensions, then it is by definition a quasi-isotropic antenna. It has no significant directivity. It takes real estate in wavelengths to make directivity. To aim that flashlight beam in one direction, your reflector on that flashlight is a significant number of wavelengths in diameter, and it's got the right shape. No matter what shape you make it, if it doesn't have enough wavelengths in diameter, it's not going to have directivity. So once you start up with an antenna with a small number of wavelengths, a very small fraction of a wavelength in E or H, it is quasi-isotropic, no real directivity. The only thing left that determines its effective capture area is its efficiency. That's what we're slowly concluding, particularly from what has been brought to our attention by John, KD2BD, and the appropriate chapter of Antenna Engineering Handbook by John Krause. So efficiency, that's all that's left. Once you establish a tuned network exposed to that incoming radio wave, and if that tuned network has enough efficiency to it, it will pick up an amount of signal equal to an isotropic antenna. An isotropic antenna at any particular frequency has a predictable effective capture area. I think it's 0.08 lambda squared, or is it 0.09, in that order. 0.08 lambda squared is the effective capture area of an isotropic antenna on any frequency if and only if the materials giving you that antenna have no insertion loss, no extra resistance, extra dielectric loss, or extra permeability loss. So, That's how the infinitesimal dipole gives you essentially the same gain as a full-size dipole if and only if you do a good enough impedance match with low loss. So, once again, I say you're going to go a slightly higher frequency and a little bit less signal because you're lowering the Q when you saturate that material. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, what do you think would happen to the directivity? Because the ferrite rod is quite directive. You start turning that radio and rotating it, you can see the difference. What do you think, will that affect the directivity of the ferrite rod?
I think the answer is no. Every one of these infinitesimal dipoles or infinitesimal H-field antennas has an antenna pattern that is that classic donut shape. That classic donut shape in three-dimensional space has a null off the ends. So your dipole has a null off the end, and your ferrite rod has a null off the end. What you're calling directivity is the null off the end. When you use it broadside, you can sweep it back and forth 30 degrees and essentially nothing happens. When you're looking at the null off the end, you sweep it 5 degrees and all hell breaks loose if the signal you're listening to is strong enough so you can really see it in that null. So you've got a very sharp null off the two ends, but it's very broad on the side. It's essentially a dipole pattern. And a dipole pattern has got something like an 85 degree beam width to it when you're being used broadside. Back to you, John. I think there's going to be very little change in the directivity. But you can do that experiment and let us know. KQRAW, you got it, John.
Very good, Dick. All right. Yeah, thank you for the answer. I will try that because that seems easy and interesting to do. And the measurement should be simple. So, okay. I'll let you go on. KC2WGV. Back to you, Dick.
Now, I've looked at the website of K3UM, is it? Yes. And he's got this set of computer programs which allows you to calculate impedance of coax and length of coax. In other words, for people who are setting up systems that are eventually going to be doing moon bounce, for instance, then this guy is giving you nice information about, let's see now if I got the right website here.
It's a VK3UM. And there are two programs in particular, transmission line calculator. So if you go to the software, you're going to see that. And the other one is going to be the impedance calculator. The screenshots, I sent you.
Yes, I see the free screenshots. Now, what do you want to know about Doug MacArthur's VK3UM's screenshots? What do you want to know about those, John? I mean, Wes?
Well, at first, hold on, let me go to it. Okay. The performance calculator. Kind of complicated. One of the things that struck me is that it starts from 50 megahertz. It goes as far as it could go to 22 gigahertz. It mentions about in a, also this one gives you the link to the antenna handbook. Absolutely amazing stuff. Telling about the frequencies and the antennas. From 10 megahertz up to 222 gigahertz. But the performance calculator by itself is a kind of big built structure. And based on looking at the screenshot, could you just give me some of your comments?
Of the three screenshots you sent me, are you interested most in screenshot number 1, 2, or 3?
3. Let me go to that. Yeah, it's 3.
I'm looking at number 3 right now. Upper right, left-hand corner is called concentric tube ratio, where you can calculate the impedance of a coax cable.
Oh, no. That's 3 in your place because you have a Linux program. Let's do it by names. One of the screenshots at the left-hand side upper corner is VK3UM performance calculator.
I'm looking at that one right now. Go ahead.
Okay, now, the left-hand side, the gray pattern, start from there and go further. On this particular one, you have a great part, like a block. We start from 1296 megahertz whatsoever, TXA home station whatsoever, and then you have a green part, and then you have a base, what color is that? And whatsoever. And then On the lower right corner, you have a parabolic reflector, which actually this part is related to the antennas. That what puzzles me also is that at the place of the antennas, you have something like Cassiopeia, Cygnus, Centaurus, Taurus, Virgo, and Termination, and Tertia.
My first guess is that this set of programs displayed on this page are the numbers that a person would want to go through when he is on paper designing his moonbound system. He gave an example in the upper left-hand corner, is that if you're on the 12 band, I'm a little bit confused by the very next square in salmon color, which says path loss 377 dB. I know that the free space loss on 1296 is not as high as 377. I think it's more like 290, so I'm a little confused by that. And so you plug in various numbers of your system. You know how big is the parabolic dish, how many watts you're transmitting, what frequency you're on, what noise figure is your receiver, what bandwidth is the receiver, and so on. You plug in all those numbers. And I'm guessing that when you go through this page and you fill in what you know and what it calculates for you, you'll find out what is the probability of success of the particular moonbound system you're planning, particularly the size of the dish, the accuracy of the reflector, the illumination taper of your feed horn, the phase errors of the feed horn. I mean, a feed horn gives you a pattern that's going to smear some energy across the parabolic dish.
We're going to give you some fault, and maybe that will be good. I download the program, I have it. The VK3UM EME calculator is written with the ability to change all the interacting parameters affecting the overall calculation, and it will automatically compute the resultant values, moon echo, signal to noise, sound noise, cold sky to ground, and moon noise. As a consequence, the critical factors that affect the magnitude and the end results become clearly evident and can become optimized to improve system performance. It will be observed that some have much greater effect than others. The interaction of these parameters will allow you to obtain a better understanding of what is required to optimize your system. Why that thing is operating from 50 megahertz up? Edward G.